Hello, everybody, and welcome to the e-learning lounge, where we'll be exploring how technology is reshaping education and training worldwide. I'm your host, Josh Sternlicht. Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of the e-learning lounge. I'm your host, Josh Sternlicht, and I'm excited to have you with us today. For those of you who are new here, which is probably most of you at this stage of our podcast, but my goal with the e-learning lounge is to have it be a space where we explore the latest trends, tools, and technologies shaping the future of learning and development, from the impact of AI on education to the ins and outs of authoring tools, adaptive learning, and instructional design strategies. We dive into what's crucial for anyone interested in how learning happens today, whether you're an educator, a corporate trainer, or just curious about the future of education. My goal is to have something here for everyone, maybe even have a few laughs, and hopefully we learn a thing or two. So with that said, let's dive into today's episode. Excuse me. Today, we're joined by Dr. Janine DeFalco, a leader in adaptive training technologies. Dr. DeFalco has pioneered the development of the Generalized Intelligent Framework for Tutoring, better known as GIFT, and chairs IEEE P2247.4, focusing on ethical AI design in education. Her awards including the NTSA Modeling and Simulation Award and recognition at the VI ITSEC conference, I hope I got that right, underscore her influence in AI, e-learning, and training. Dr. DeFalco combines psychology with technology to enhance learning outcomes. Dr. DeFalco, Janine, we're thrilled and honored to have you with us today. Thank you.
Thanks. And actually, I have upgraded my, I shouldn't say upgrade, that's bad. Now I'm actually working with in the nuclear submarine field. So
with the Navy.
Yeah. So I'm working on the Electric Boat Groton site for the workforce development. Yeah.
So, okay, great. And that's, I wanted to get to Electric Boat, your work with the Navy. And that's also partners with General Dynamics. Is that correct?
Yeah. So General Dynamics is kind of like the parent company, and Electric Boat is where they're making the Virginia and Columbia class nuclear submarine. And so the Navy is kind of like our customer, basically.
Got it.
Yeah. And so I'm a contractor there for Electric Boat, and basically just trying to help them integrate some technology to support their training of the vocational trades, electricians, carpenters, inside welders, machinists, that kind of thing.
Okay. You know, we're on the topic. I'll get to what I wanted to start with, but I mean, we're talking about it, and I have, you know, I don't, for the layman, you know, I rattled off all of these things like the Generalized Intelligent Framework for Tutoring. Maybe we can talk about that. I did a little bit of my homework. I know what IEEE stands for, the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. I know what the ITSEC conference is, the Industry Training Simulation and Education Conference. But I really, you know, I don't know what they are. I would love for you to talk about that. Maybe what you're doing right now. How are you training the Navy? What you're creating for them? Maybe we just dive into that.
Sure. Well, I'll start with the IEEE is a global standards group, basically. So around the world, it's open. People can join to help drive standards in, you know, mostly technology. The way that I explain to people is the way that you go into Wi-Fi in a library, and then you're able to go to Wi-Fi at Starbucks and still get connected. That's because of a IEEE standard that set that interoperability standard for the industry. So my work with IEEE is looking at AI and how are we designing and developing for learning technology platforms. What are some of the recommended practices that we want to tell engineers, designers, developers, people who want to buy these products? So that's IEEE. ITSEC is the largest simulation and training conference in the world. I think they get like anywhere between 14,000 to 18,000 people that go through their doors. It's the biggest trade show for modeling and simulations. Basically, it's the Orange County Convention Center in Orlando. The downstairs, it's like a football field. It's huge, and it's all like rocket launchers, K's, whatever, anything technology you could think of. It's sponsored by the Armed Forces, and so I would say like three quarters of it is really geared toward DOD. The other part of it is really for medical simulations. That's a big industry too. That's that stuff. Generalized Intelligent Framework for Tutoring is an open source modular ecosystem for an intelligent tutoring system that the Army started to develop 2010, 2012. And I was working on that for a couple of years. That's your tax dollars at work. Basically, you can go to gifttutoring.org and you can get a log on and you can get access actually to the platform. So it's a pretty cool tool. So that's
Excellent.
all that stuff. Yeah.
Got it. Got it. And so, and when you're you've been working with I know you wrote the book, The Front Lines of Artificial Intelligence Ethics. And so when you're working with IEEE in the Navy and coming up with curriculum, is that what you're for? Let's talk about, I guess, the Electric Boat and what you're doing there and how AI kind of fits in all that. And
All right, so at Electric Boat, it's a big operation, right? Like there's only, I think, the Electric Boat up in Groton. They also have a facility up in Quonset Point, Rhode Island. And then there's a not us, but like there's just one other manufacturing installation. I think it's in Newport News, Virginia. And they're the only places that are really building the submarines. That's my understanding. And the problem with the submarine space is everybody wants one for obvious reasons, right? They carry Tomahawk missiles or just their or nuclear weapons proper, lots of different kinds, and they're stealthy, right? And
I want one. Let's go. Can I
yeah,
get one?
right? Stand in line. So the idea is that part of the problem is, like, I think in my understanding is in the 80s, after the Cold War, everyone said, oh, we don't need submarines anymore. So basically they like decimated the submarine industry because they said we're going to have world peace, haha. So a lot of the people who've been building it for a long time left the industry, right? So we lost a lot of institutional knowledge on how to actually make submarines because you can't offshore this work. Like you can't bring it to India, you can't bring it to China, you can't bring, it's got to be made in the United States, and it's a highly secure, very, some of it's secret, top secret, because you're talking nuclear weapons, right? So the training of the people who actually assemble these behemoths is an effort. And part of the limitation is we actually don't use a lot of technology to help support train them in these new paths. A lot of people don't even know how to like change the chain on their bicycle. I remember I had that like as a kid. I would tinker with my parents' television because it wasn't working. Some of us are just kind of mechanically interested or inclined, but a lot of the people, or these are at least a subset of the population that comes to Electric Boat in the manufacturing trades, they don't want to go to college, or they think college is a losing proposition because you get tons of student loan debt. And this, at least in Groton, it's a for the trades, it's a union job, right? So there's some stability in that, but we need to train people on basically how to do manufacturing, and on the deck plate. So at the shipyard itself, you can't have anything cloud-based because we're worried about security issues. So that's something, that's part of what I'm doing there, is trying to say, what can we do, right? Is there stuff that we can do that would not be a IT cybersecurity threat or vulnerability, but that we could still support the kind of that, accelerate that training, right, to learn a new skill so we can build these submarines, because I think we're behind schedule.
So are you coming up with curriculum to build the submarines? Is that what you're?
No. So I mean, we get the engineers who have the blueprints, right? So, and they're super complex,
Yeah.
but You've got, if you've ever worked with engineers, they're kind of like on one side of the room, and then it's like everybody else who doesn't understand what they do. They're like, no, it makes sense to you. And so they have these blueprint, literally they're blueprints, they're the work orders, and you bring them to trades folks to say, like, I need you to bring this thing to this location on the hull, right, and insert, wire, build, whatever. And some people have never been on a boat, like they don't know what port starboard is, like, so you know, like literally, like
It's
they
like
don't
me.
know how to, yeah, they don't know how to navigate it. So what I've been, we have technical analysts and we have instructional designers and we have subject matter experts who are helping to build a very robust pipeline of training, but that's usually instructor led, so in person or e-learning, right? So you go on a computer and you learn some stuff. And then we have, so that's the kind of the beginning of the pipeline. And then when you actually get hired and you're going onto the deck plate, we have called active learning centers. So we've got like master electricians, master welders, and people who made it through the first phase of their training. Then they go and they work for, they study under these people for a while. It's kind of, you know, like trade skills, you know, when they used to have like trade skills. It's kind of like that. And then eventually they get moved out to start actually building the thing out on the floor, out on the dock. So my work has been trying to go in there and say, what can we do to help accelerate that novice to hit the ground running, right? So build designing and trying to build like some simulations to teach them, like, hey, this is what the inside of submarine looks like, and this is where a frame would be, and this is how you could navigate, and here's a task for you to figure out how to read your blueprint and then to navigate to where you need to be in order to do your actual job.
Well,
So
yeah,
that's what
sorry.
I'm trying to work on.
Well, let me get specific then. That's crazy. That's awesome. So how do you bridge that gap between, I guess, like theoretical knowledge and practical application, you know, in these initiatives?
That's an excellent question. And I think historically we always struggle with that, right? You learn a thing in a classroom, and then you have to go do the thing not in a classroom, and that transfer of knowledge is a struggle. And so I think historically all domains we struggle with that. Like, we know we need to teach people things, but the problem is, like, what's the best way to teach them? What's the best delivery method to do that? You know, and then some of that comes down to, this is my bias, right? My bias is to say, like, historically we've thought about like how people learn. You know, it goes all the way back to tabula rasa, right? Like, people are blank slates. Was that Rousseau? You know, people are born blank slates, and we're gonna like imprint and be able to shape them into who they want to be. And we're like, yeah, that's not actually how it works. And so, you know, we've gone through centuries of people trying to understand how the mind works, how the brain works, how people learn, you know, what makes somebody, one person is born and they're an emperor, right, of the Roman Empire, and somebody else is born and they're shoveling crap in a stable, you know. And how does that, is it just money? Is it just family? Is it just environment? Is it experience? Like, what is the thing that prohibits all people from really kind of fully actualizing themselves? And not just learning a thing, but then doing the thing and doing it well. So I don't know that that's a new issue. I think historically, again, like when we look at psychology, which really came out of philosophy was saying, hey, this is how we think. This is, you know, what it means to be human. This is how the mind works. And then as we got to really like the turn of the 20th century, like the early 19, well, yeah, probably, like, so John Dewey was a philosopher, and then he became like a psychologist. Like, he kind of turned, he was in the early 1900s, and they were saying, like, there's got to be a better way to figure out how to get people to learn stuff and do stuff. And that's where we start moving into more of the science of learning and the science of education, measuring things, measuring people. IQ tests, right, came out of the army because they said, I got all these enlisted people, what the hell do I do with them? You know, it's like a mass of humanity, and you're like, you're gonna be an artillery person. You're sitting behind a desk. You guys are gonna go dig in a tunnel, and you guys are gonna go home to your mothers because you just should never have signed up to begin with, right? And the IQ test was really a sorting, right, to figure out people's competencies and their abilities so you could place them in the right right job, basically. So all that to say that as we've learned more about how the brain operates, how people learn, like what's involved with it, right? Like, so there used to be this information processing model where with computers, they're like, the brain is like a computer and we will input information and people will spit it out. And you're like, nope, that's not how it works either, right? Like,
Right.
you tell me something today, give me an hour, I've forgotten.
Right.
Right? I
Yes.
mean,
Welcome to
so
my world,
we,
right?
right? I mean, and so like we all, to a certain extent, we said, okay, well, that's not where it's at. So now I say over the last certainly 30 years, 20, 30 years, we're more about understanding that knowledge is learning by doing, right? So there was a Russian psychologist called Vygotsky, and I don't know if you ever heard of scaffolding learning. You know, you scaffold something. So
Not,
it's,
nope.
oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it's an educate. If you've been a teacher, you've heard this, like scaffolding instruction. What does that mean? That means if I'm teaching how to read, first I'm going to show you maybe the letters, right? Maybe I'm going to
Okay.
read to you, show you pictures. Then I'm going to have you sound out letters or try and figure out what does the image mean? How does that correlate to words, right? So we're building, right,
Yeah.
incrementally different layers of fluency. That's called scaffolding. And so Vygotsky was a in Russia in 1970s, and we only got hit. He died pretty young, but we got some of his thinking on how people learn not until the much later 90s, you know,
Okay.
really. And but he talked about this zone of proximal development, and the zone of proximal development is saying like there's like a sweet spot between you know nothing. Now you kind of know something if I help you, and now you know it so much you don't need me anymore, right? That's that notion of scaffolding. So we have all these different
Okay.
theories and understanding how the mind works from neuroscience and experiments, but it's, you know, complex, right?
Yeah.
Because we have different prior knowledge, different experiences, preferences, we learn different ways. So to answer your question, how do you get them? And how do you make those decisions about other people to accelerate their proficiency? And we're still working on it, right?
Got it. Yeah. Well, see, that was
That's a
my
short answer.
Well, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I was gonna say, like, are there specific examples where these techniques like have improved training outcomes? Can you
Oh,
give,
yeah.
yeah?
Well, yeah, I mean, like, so we know, like, some things, like, we know some, so okay, what's a good example? Okay, so repetition is a good one, right? Spacing is another. So those are concepts we say, if you repeat it enough times, you're probably gonna remember it. If I tell it to you, we walk away from it, and then we come back to it and we walk away from it, and we come back to it again. That spacing notion means that, you know, the mind has the ability after that repetition that it won't, if we reintroduce the content before you've forgotten it, it will help bring it into long-term memory better, right? So those are
Yeah.
some kinds of things that we kind of take a look at. There's also one of my favorite scholars is this woman, Mickey Chi, and she was out of Arizona State, and she did a bunch of research looking at your question, how do people learn? What's
Right.
the best way, right? And passive learning is I'm sitting there and you're talking at me for like an hour, does nothing, right? Then there's some collaborative, right, or cooperative, you know, kind of collaborative learning where you learn with other people, and that can work. But if you've ever done group work, sometimes not, right? Like you got one person doing the work and nobody else is doing it, so that's not always really successful. But she talks about interactive learning, and she also goes as far as to say like the dialogic learning. So, and you've heard this, like if you can teach it, you know it. Like if you could say
Right.
it, you know it. If you can't articulate it, you probably don't know it. And that's kind of the same idea is if you're interacting with the material and then you're able to perform on it, for lack of a better word, then you probably know it. And so because we understand that concept, now we look at technologies and say, okay, if that's our understanding, is it's more effective if people are interacting with material and applying their knowledge and testing and experimenting. How can we use these technologies to kind of support that mode or that design, right? That modality of delivery.
And that this might be a good segue then into your book because of the technology. So the front lines of artificial intelligence ethics, right? One of the things you discuss are psychological impacts of AI, human AI interaction. Do you, before I ask a question, can you want to just can you give a synopsis of like what you're talking about, what the main points are, and or I can come out. Yeah, tell me.
So the book, so basically the book came out of it's a collaboration with my friend Dr. Drew Hampton. He's at Christian Brothers University, and we got a bunch of scholars together and said, and again, this was, gosh, it's been a while now, right? Because that thing came out 2017 or something. No, when did that come out? 2020? It's been a couple of years.
20, yeah.
2020, right? Something like that.
2020, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, and so when we were first putting it together, which was like 2018, 2019, thinking and asking people to contribute books because people do not write fast, right? And to say, hey, what is your thinking in this space of AI, right? And how is it going to affect people? That's the psychology of it. And then what are the ethical things that we should be thinking about that we need to prepare for? Because if you know anything about technology, more often than not, we develop a capability, we deploy it, and we're like, holy crap, we blew up an entire nation, right?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Whoops.
Oops.
And
Yep.
so, right, so that we don't want to do that.
Yeah.
And so that was the idea behind the book, is to get people who are kind of in this learning engineering space, for lack of a better word, to say, what is your thinking about how this emerging technology is going to affect people, how they think, how they interact, how they learn, and then what are the things that we should kind of prepare for, or you know, because again, if we don't, we can build the technology, but if we don't think through the analysis of, for example, what happens if this gets in the hands of a bad actor,
Right.
then we're not really doing our due diligence. We're just throwing stuff out into the ether. And I've heard this a lot, which is, hey, I just make it. It's not my problem what people do with it. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't think that as a society, we should just be building stuff that causes harm
Yeah.
with no accountability.
I just my last my first guess I had was Professor David Rubenstein. I'm actually friends with him, but he's a law professor. You might you might be interested in it actually. And he talks about like how AI is going to be regulated, and then he you know what we as a society how responsible we are with this new technology. And I think he called it AI literacy. What, right? Do you know? Can you talk about like AI literacy from what we got was like everybody needs to understand what's going on because we don't want it to get into the hands of bad apples here because we all have to know we all are stakeholders when it comes to this new technology, right? Yeah.
So the so AI literacy, interesting, right? Because I've been writing a proposal on trying to support AI literacy. So, well timed. I
Yeah.
think the problem with AI literacy is that we haven't really come to, as an industry or a domain, to say, like, this is what AI literacy means for everybody. Like, you have math literacy, reading literacy, and people who are in that space are like, yep, we agree. Like, math literacy, you need to know how to add, divide, multiply, you know what I mean? But
Yeah.
when you talk about AI literacy, I don't think there's really quite a consensus yet of what that means. My perspective is it's really two things, right? At least, but one is, what the hell is AI? Can I
Right.
say hell? Am I allowed to
Yeah.
say hell?
Yeah, of
What the
course.
hell is AI, right? What does that mean? And I'll be honest. So, like, I chair this one of the working groups for IEEE, and it's on, you know, trying to develop a recommended practice for risk transparency with developing these AI systems. And the first question, the first thing I said was, well, we really should define AI. And it was like dead silence, like nobody spoke. And I know, and afterwards they're like, do we really want to go there? That was kind of the question.
Right. Yes, we have
Like,
to.
well, and that's what I said. I said, well, how the heck do we have a standard if we don't even understand what we're talking about? We have to at least say this is the thing we're talking about, because in AI, there's at this point lots of different kinds of AI, right? You've got a human in the loop, you have a human who's not in the loop, right? There, and there's so different ways of building the models, deploying the models, embedding, you know, so there's all of this complexity around AI itself and a lack of a consistent definition. My personal favorite is anything that substitutes human judgment and reasoning. I call that AI, right? Because that's really what it is. It's
Right.
making
Yeah.
a decision for me without me, doing it myself.
Yeah.
From a decision-making perspective. So, like ChatGPT, right? I could put in a prompt and say, write me a cover letter to apply to PGLS,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And then it'll do the thinking for me. And then I can go in and I can edit it, right? But like I don't have to think a lot. I could just give it some keywords and it will generate something for me. That's AI as a does that make them so that's my
Yeah, yeah,
definition.
yeah.
So you have that. So you have the what the hell is AI? And then you have the actual the design, development, and implementation of AI. And those considerations, which from an education perspective, I think are things that we need to teach students, how do we use it? What does it mean? How do we verify output for AI systems? How do we engage in kind of help-seeking behaviors when we have an output? How do we verify that this is something that we can have reliance on? What's our confidence in that output? Have we verified the sources? Again, it's kind of like when the internet was coming about, because I remember that. That's how old I am. And it was
Yeah.
just because it's on the
Me
internet
too.
doesn't mean
Yeah.
it's true, right? I mean,
Right.
and it's the same idea with AI is to say that, and then how do we verify those sources? So,
Yeah.
does that, so the AI
Yeah.
literacy thing is in and of itself has become a super complex topic.
It's very complicated, and we spoke about, I think, what you were just getting at, like the information coming in, bad stuff can be coming in, bad stuff be coming out, because the where is we're all using this technology right now. It's all so new. Like you said, when the internet came out, everyone's like, ah, it's they're scared, we're excited, all that. But the truth is that we don't really fully understand that people aren't thinking about it. And this is what's important, like all the biases that are happening, right? I mean, where is it getting its information? And then I had this great this point was, and forgive me, I think you it was it's called like RHLF. It was like human.
Yeah, reinforcement of human learning.
Yes. So, where, okay, there are human beings that are working with AI. So, if it's spewing out information that is incorrect or even harmful, there's a human there that can be correcting it. But then it's like, okay, but who is this? This human also has maybe a bias at, right? And so it's like
Okay,
this,
so
yeah.
funny you say that because one of my job I have a couple jobs. Like one of my other part-time little gigs that I do is I actually do that. I do that for
Okay.
a company who will remain nameless just so I don't get in trouble.
Okay.
And it is
Wow.
training large language models, right? And so the task is there's a prompt from some user somewhere in the universe, right? And it says, I don't know, see what I don't, like what oh I have one today. It was what is the typical compensation package in Canada? Like that's it. That was
Okay.
the prompt. Okay. And so then there were two different outputs that I had to evaluate. And it was one was drawing on a website that said, when you think about compensation in Canada, you're thinking about, your pay and your health insurance, blah, blah, blah. Right. So that was one. I was like, that's pretty good. But I had to rank it and I had to critique it. And the critique was it mostly answers the prompt, but the user asked for a typical work package and the site actually didn't give me something that was typical. It just said what the options were. Right. So it
Okay.
still didn't fully answer that. And then the other link had absolutely nothing to do with compensation for from a job. It talked about severance compensation. I'm like, so we call that a hallucination. Like
Right.
that has no way did that answer. And so in that effort, we're ranking, we're adjusting. But I will say this, I've gone toe to toe with people who review my work when you have to make inferences. Let's say like you have a long chat history and then sometimes that chat history you're referring back to something you did prior, right? And you're asking the bot to basically like refine something from a previous query. And that kind of ambiguity
Yeah.
You know, and I did what I thought was a stellar logical deductive reasoning to say if A then B equals C, therefore D, right? Like I'm going through, say this is why it should be entered this way, and I was told unequivocally, no, you're wrong, it's this other thing. And at some point you give up arguing and say, fine, whatever, right?
See,
And I know I should have just kept arguing. Because I really fundamentally believe that they were wrong in their analysis, but
when you say they, you're talking about a human you were talking
a
having
human,
this.
yeah, it was like a supervisor that was doing my work, and you know, of course, what I really want to say is, do you know who I am? You know, whatever, like, do you know who you're talking to? Which is not the right answer, and I didn't do that, but I thought it, and it doesn't matter, right? Because in that particular instance, I had no power. I was being reviewed, and they just rejected what I'm doing. So, and okay, doing the meta-analysis, this is another one of those ethical concerns, which is to say, why is this person more qualified than me to make that value judgment? Because that's really what it was. It was a value judgment, and it was a philosophical, you know, deductive reasoning on a premise. And I really wanted to say on what grounds. I mean, I freaking went to, I did citations because I'm a nerd, right? I'm like giving citations and philosophical, logical argument reasoning. Nope, didn't matter. They didn't like my response. So it is a limited process, but this is where, again, education, when we're, you know, who's in charge, right?
Well,
Who's in
that's
charge
what,
of these
yes.
decisions? Yeah.
You hear that example, and I'm just thinking, well, what makes that person correct and you incorrect? And then as we're trying to
Right.
help AI, are we really helping it? Like, how do you get down to the, I, so it's a, it is complicated.
Right,
I
because what
don't.
you're really talking about is an epistemology. You're talking about how do we know what we know? And how do we know what we know is true? Right. And that is an age old that, you know, they say everything footnotes to Plato, right? And one of the, it's like, what is chair? What is a chair? A chair is this. Like, well, is that a chair? Is that a chair? And so this is not a problem that's new. And you know, for thousands of years, arguing with other people to say it's one God. No, it's many gods. No, it's this God. No, it's that God. Like, how the hell do you know which is the source of truth is not going away,
So
right?
at this point in time, is it fair to say we're doing the best we can to create AI as unbiased as possible, but it's still complicated, and it might be forever impossible to make this technology not have its own opinions from all the information it gets.
You know, I that's such a great question. I would want to say we're doing the best that we can. Yes. I would say that, I mean, my philosophical vantage is that there's no way to avoid bias, right? At least as we train these, because, you know, we have limited perspective, right? Because I wear glasses. And so I would always say to people, like, I can only see in front of me, right? And even then, it's limited because I need glasses. I can't see behind me. I can't see above me, right? Like, I'm limited in my viewpoint. And so, by the very limitation of my vantage point, I'm going to be biased because I only see certain things. We all just see certain things. And then we have prior experiences and then our deeply held beliefs. And, you know, it's all this, the psychological complexity of what it means to be a person. Right. Like my mother told me, never wear a skirt over my knees or whatever the heck it is. Like you're indoctrinated to believe certain things are right and other things are wrong. And trying to get people to think differently is probably one of the most impossible things we have as a human population, which is why we go to war and blow the shit out of each other because it's like, this is your border. No, that's your border. It's like, whatever. It's, you know, I mean, so I think when you have people who are trying to establish baseline truths without bias, I'm highly suspect that it's actually going to be executed, you know, 100%.
So we're doing the best we can, and I know there's a lot of we get bogged down with negative speak sometimes about AI. There is a lot of good stuff too, and I want to talk about that positive stuff if possible. If you could say, Here's my question. The question is, what role could AI play in creating more personalized and adaptive learning experiences? Is that something,
It's a great question. Yes.
have you used AI in that way?
So, sort of, and I plan to, and I'm actually doing a workshop tomorrow for the some of the faculty at the University of New Haven on this very topic, right?
Okay.
Because when generative AI came out, faculty in particular were like, "Holy crap!" It's like everybody's using it, and they're writing essays, and it's plagiarism, and they're not allowed to use it, and if they use it, then we're gonna remove them from schools. And I'm like, man, it's oh, game's over, right? Frickin' Pandora's box, it's gone. Like you're not putting it back in the box; it's out. So the issue for me was, how, to your point, like, so how do we use AI to not put it back in the box, but to really take a look at what is it that we're teaching, and what does it mean to learn, right? So this is the basic premise for my workshop, which is, I think, at least in academia, pre-K through 12 in particular, and I would also argue definitely in undergrad, the most instruction is to teach you a thing, and then I know you know the thing if I can measure it, that you can recall it, right? So I give you a test. And most of those tests is just remembering, right? So that remembering thing is like, if you've got a good short-term memory, you're going to do well in school. If you got a crap short-term memory, then you might want to go do something else, right? Because school may not be your forte, because that's the thing that we've said is important, is that you are remembering these things. Now, you need to remember some things, right? Like, you need to know the alphabet and how to, you need certain fluency, right? So you need those foundational skills. But my argument is to say, like, when we look at AI, AI is really helping us accelerate some of that fluency. Why? Right. If I'm writing, I was actually just helping a doctoral student the other day, and she's trying to write a qualifying paper. And when I first got her paper, the struct I couldn't understand the logic of the construction of the argument that she was making in the paper, because it wasn't, it needed better organization, right? I couldn't understand, how did we get from the first argument to the second to the conclusion? So if she were to have been allowed to use AI, which I don't think she was, but if she would have, she could have put her paper into the chat and said, "Please organize this for me," right? So as opposed to me struggling and sitting there for hours trying to figure out where all the pieces went, I could accelerate that process, get it in order, then I can go back to my documents. And I could say, okay, now what are my sources? Am I making, you know, because as I'm going through editing the paper, I said, "You're making this claim, but I don't see any evidence for it. Where is the citation for this? Where is, you know, you're making a broad statement. Where's the data for that?" So those are the kinds. So now I look at it as to say, we can use AI to accelerate beyond me doing some of the minutiae of like writing an outline that could take frickin' forever, and to get meat of the ideas. And then the idea in the classroom is to say, if we're using it as opposed to remember, what we're doing is we can use it as a way to say, let's now analyze the output, right? Actually, I wrote this down. If you look at Bloom's taxonomy, which is one of my favorite things to look at, and if you look at Bloom's taxonomy, there's like a whole bunch of levels to like, the bottom is remember, right? So we can recognize, recall facts, and I would say most of education has been that. But then we have to understand what these facts mean. Okay. So how do we represent our understanding? The workshop that I'm going to present, I say, you know, one way to do that is we can actually use a tool like DALL-E, right? Or the Sora, right? So we can say, here is my understanding about a concept. Now let's do a pictorial representation of that, and then I will explain what that means. So I can both represent my knowledge visually, right, or in the video, and then I can explain how these images can represent my understanding of this concept. Applying it, right? Applying it would be something like, if you're in an AR or VR game-based training, right, that you can actually take what you remember and you understand, and you can apply it in this simulated environment, And then when you're analyzing the output of any of these systems, that's another level of critical thinking. We have to analyze the validity, right? The relevance. And then we evaluate the quality of the work, right? And so that's another, if I've already, if they, if Ch ChatGPT has already done the lift of the outline, then my job really should be I'm evaluating the output and saying, yes, this captures what I think, or no, it does not. And then the final product is that the synthesis of that AI human teaming to create something that's novel, right? And so that's going up the whole Bloom's revised taxonomy. And so the idea is to say we're reimagining education to say that it's not the most important thing is not only to remember and to test term memory. It's to be able to do all these other things because the expert is not the person that can do what everybody does. Right. The expert is able to problem solve in a novel, chaotic environment or where it hasn't been done before. And I say that that's what we should be, developing for our students.
And that's where we're using AI. That's where we're working together with AI, using it as a tool to help us in that way, to accelerate the process, to kind of, jog a little glimpse of inspiration when we need it. That's where it's perfect right now in certain scenarios.
Yeah, well, even you think about first responders, right? You think about drones, we or active shooter environments. Well, who the heck wants to walk into an active shooter environment? Who, you know, I mean, really, let's just be honest. And then emergency situations. A great example is like subterranean warfare, urban warfare, where you can't see anything, you can't communicate. Like you're gonna put people underground; they may not get out again. From a military perspective. That AI human teaming, it will not just accelerate, hopefully, a successful completion of the mission, but potentially save lives because you're not putting a person down there that's going to go, lose oxygen and can't come back, from underground. You can send a drone out there to kind of scout, like, where is that shooter? What's happening? And so you can be more tactical and you have more information. So I think it's not all bad. But certainly, again, you think through the analysis to say, okay, well, we can make these drones that can go and give us surveillance information, but then what happens if it's showing up outside my bathroom when I'm taking a shower, right? Like, and that's where we say we have to have some kind of safeguards, some regulations to be able to make sure that it's not used for ill intent or to harm. Right. I mean, the first principle for one of my standards for the recommended practices of the ethical considerations of AI systems, the very first principle is this notion of human flourishing. Right. So if you're designing and building an AI system that is going to threaten or impede human flourishing, we should probably reconsider that or heavily regulate it. Right. Like we are not all allowed to build like nuclear bombs in our backyard. Right. So why would that be any different for any other kind of technology?
I want you to hear the my first episode. I think you'd find you all the people. I think you might find it interesting. And then I'm gonna have to connect you with Professor Rubenstein. You guys have a lot in common in what you are working on. This is the e-learning lounge, so I want to ask an e-learning question. And you've created a lot of e-learning curriculum and courses. So I want to ask, what are the biggest challenges you've encountered in e-learning, and particularly in ensuring learners remain engaged and motivated? How do you address that?
Yeah, I think again, I think if you approach e-learning as I'm going to load a lecture and make people write papers, it's a snore fest, right? Like, who cares? And really, it's not in, my first principle of teaching or instructional design is if people are not paying attention, they're not learning. That's basically it. Like, they're not focusing on the content. So the way that I've gotten around that from an e-learning perspective is I require as homework, like you say, okay, you got to read this chapter or something, right? Or find some sources or whatever it is, the thing that you want them to think about some content. And usually my first homework assignment is you need to generate three inquiry questions from that reading assignment, not it's finding. Like, I don't care who Albert Einstein is. Like, I want to know things that are more open-ended, right? What do you know? What don't you know? So some of them could be, okay, you've read this paper, you've read this chapter. What don't you understand, or what do you want to know more about? Like, those are the questions. And then they have to post those. And then I say, and you have to respond for a minimum 250 words. So no yes or no answers. You have to respond to your peers' questions and engage in a dialogue. And that's how I structure it. So I compel them to interact with each other. I compel them to ask questions. And the truth of the matter is, you have to read the material. You can't ask the question.
Right, you have to know what you don't know or
Right.
type of thing. Right, yeah.
That whole metacognition stuff. So that's how I do that. And then some of the other things that I'll try and do are things like, okay, I want you to pick something that's of interest to you or you want to know more about, and I'll structure a project. And then the final presentation, maybe I'll have them do a little annotated bibliography, which again, they could ChatGPT it, whatever. But the whole point is, hopefully, they're doing some reading because it's of interest to them.
Yeah.
But then the final product is that they have to report out their findings and either do it in person if it's an in-person class, but if it's an e-learning class, then I make them do a video of themselves talking about it so I can hear
Oh,
them
great. Yeah.
be art like, because if they've done the work, they should be fluent, they should be articulate. If they haven't done the work, then they're reading off a script and they're struggling. And so you can
Yeah.
kind of like who's done it, who's not done it.
That certainly solves engagement. You have to be on, taking a video. And so that's excellent. Yeah, I
And I
love
don't want to
that.
hear like, oh, I don't know how to do a video. You're a TikTok generation. Like, figure it out. Like,
Right.
I will walk you through if you honestly have never
Yeah.
done a video before, and I will help you do this. But yeah, you're
Yeah.
doing a video with you on it, and I'm watching your face do that presentation because to me, again, they don't want to listen to me talk. They don't care. Highly unlikely that they care, but they certainly like to hear themselves talk.
Right.
So.
It's funny. This here's another segue. I was going to start with this, and you might have just a answered the question, but and we spoke about this when we first a little bit when we first met. I just thought it was so cool that I love that you hold master's degrees in drama studies from Johns Hopkins University and educational theater from New York University. I just because I come from a theatrical background as well. My
Sure.
question was like, I was just curious, what drew you to those fields and how have they influenced, even though you might have just said it a little bit, but how have they influenced your approach to training, but not just training, psychology and education throughout your career for everything that you're doing, from those students that you just spoke about to the Navy?
Yeah, well, I mean, I stumbled into the theater very young, like probably a lot of people, right?
Right.
This is like 7th grade. I know it really was. It was 7th grade. 7th grade, I went to a Catholic school. They were doing The Sound of Music, and my 7th grade teacher, her name was Miss Butts. It was. That was her name, Miss Butts. And we had no one that
Miss
could play.
Butts.
It was Miss Butts. And
Okay.
she told me not only she I'll never forget, she says, make sure you wear a moisturizer under your eyes so you don't have bags. And like I never forgot it. But this we had
Best
auditions
advice.
for this. It was the best advice I ever got. But we were doing auditions for The Sound of Music, and we didn't have anybody that could play the piano. And I nominally, right? And so she asked if I would play the piano for the school doing the auditions. And so it was after school. We're all, the whole damn school's there auditioning. And then she turned to me and she goes, Janine, would you like to audition? And I was like, no, but fine, whatever. I did it. And as I'm playing and I'm singing, I don't know, like my favorite things, I was like, wow,
Yeah.
that person's got like a really good voice. And I was like, holy shit, that's me. Like
Ah, that's awesome.
I had never heard myself sing out loud before. And that kind of like thrust me into this whole theater thing, which I had not expected, right? Because I was still a nerd even back then. But I always loved what I loved about theater was you could have words on a page. And then you had to make them manifest, right? Like you had to materialize those ideas, and that the options of how you would construct meaning to me was always very fascinating. And so, like, I started as an actor, like probably most people in the theater, and then I was super frustrated with directors who would say stupid shit like, take it up a notch or make a different choice, which drove me nuts. I'm like, that tells me nothing. And so then I went into directing because what I realized
Place
about
the emphasis on in. It's in.
I mean, and I would argue as an actor, I'm like, yeah, no, but this doesn't make, there's no logical consistency. Didn't matter. So I'm like, fine, I'll be a director. So I did the directing because for me, directing was teaching, right? It was like, I see an actor, they're doing something, it's not making sense, they're not connecting, the overreacting, underreacting. And I can't, my worst thing as a director, I would say, do you know what that line means? And invariably the actor would be like, no. I'd be like, well, if you don't, your audience won't. So like, you
Right,
have to
of
understand
course.
what you're saying, or no one else is going to understand it. And so that process of really, the psychologists call that, like, it's almost like an embodied cognition, right? That's what I came to realize. But that embodying the text and creating meaning through gesture and the words and the tone and, all of the other elements that go into what it means to be a performer, to me was, as a director and then as an educator, I was like, there's something in this, right? And there was something in the way I would have different actors who could memorize a text and come on stage in rehearsal, and I could move them around anywhere, and it didn't matter where the hell I put them, and they would still remember their text. And I would others who I'd say, go stage right, go stage left, come down center, I could see them touching the space and doing their lines. So they were rooting the lines in spatially, right? When I stand here, I say this line. When I stand over here, I say this line, which to me was a fascinating because just the different processes of how people, again, retained all this information. So I went to, so and that was basically, going back for my master's at NYU, recognizing that there's something in the arts, right? As we try to understand the world around us, and the meaning making and the retention of knowledge. And then I went to Columbia because at that point they were really into this notion of embodied cognition. They wanted somebody that had a background in theater, go figure. And then I got involved in this, all of this technology mediated experiences, right? So the AR, the VR, the game-based learning. And I think we talked about this, right? Like what really struck me is, like, you say embodied cognition, I say acting, right? You say all these things like, you guys just figured this out, like Greeks figured this out like 2,000 years ago, but okay. And so just the being able to bridge those two disciplines, like what we learned from the arts and people who create meaning from nothing or from bare, almost nothing, and what that means to do that, right? Making a choice, making a better choice, discriminating between I'm going to yell here or not yell, right? Like, this Hamlet was an insecure asshole, or, he was actually a calculating prick, whatever it is, like you make all these choices in the arts. And in a similar way in education, we also make choices, but they don't think of them as choices. They just think, well, you need to know these things. They're still choices. So that's how I got into this space, is to say, you're using this technology that's requiring more than just memory. It's a construction of meaning. And my feeling was, we can leverage some of the things we've learned from the arts to help inform those designs, right? To make it more effective. And that's really how I got into this space. Because again, if people aren't paying attention, they're not learning. And you know that, like, you go see bad theater, like, please just put a fork in my eye. Like, I'd rather do absolutely anything but sit here and watch this terrible play. But when it's good, right, it's like time has passed, you don't even know, right? Like, it's it. And in psychology, they talk about the flow. Like, you get in this flow as a performer or in a really good production. And it's not just that it transports you, it subsumes you, right? And it stays with you, right? It and that's really, I think, and the best kind of learning experiences, that's what we're aiming for. People to be engaged, we want them to be motivated, we want them to be inspired, right? We
In
want them
that
to
flow
not,
that you're
yeah,
saying.
get the flow. We want them to take that feeling, that inspiration, that motivation, and then find their own path with it, right? Like, have it be something that propels them to meaningful living, right? Meaningful employment. So I don't know if I answered your question, but
No, you
that's how
did.
I
You
started.
totally did. That was so, and it's so cool how you laid out the clear path of how you got into the arts, why you moved into education and how the arts help you teach and present and how you engage with your, students, whoever you're teaching.
Oh, yeah.
So that was so cool. No, you totally did. I want to do something fun.
Yeah.
We're almost done. So, but I figured I was thinking since we both have a somewhat theatrical background, I went to the Actor's Studio. And did you
Oh,
ever
yeah.
you saw that show with the great late James Lipton inside the Actor's Studio? Okay, great. So that and he would always ask the those questions at the end by the French host Bernard Pivot. And so I'm not going to ask him all of them, but being a fellow thespian, I figure okay. I'll pay homage to my James Lipton, my
That's
dean.
awesome.
Okay, so the first we'll do two,
Okay.
maybe three. We'll see. What is your favorite curse word, Dr. DeFalco?
Ah, gee, the F word every single day of the
You
week.
can say it. Say
Fuck. Yeah.
it.
It's such a perfect for everything, right? It's
It
like when
is.
good, bad, frustrating, it's just the best word.
It is. It is. And there's all the variations. And even if you put another curse word, you're using that word. So you really just have to, it's just the F word. I agree.
It
And then here's a good one. Let's see. What profession would you not like to do?
What profession would I not like to do? I would not like to be, oh gosh, I don't think I want to be a social worker. I know that sounds terrible. I just
No,
think
it's honest. That's what we're here
I think I
for.
would be sad all the time. I just I, really, I feel
Bless the
like,
social workers. It's true. It's a tough
yeah,
job.
it's so hard to deal with other people's pain, you know.
Yes.
I think it would overwhelm me.
Yeah, I'm very thankful for my Dr. Sherman. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no social work for me.
No social. Well, Dr. Janine DeFalco, thank you. Seriously, thank you so much for joining us
Thank
today.
you. I had
Yeah.
fun. I'm sorry for the profanity, but
I
don't
love
let
the profanity.
it
That
get away.
that's at the e-learning lounge, anything goes, you know.
That's awesome.
And you've been great and insightful
Thank
to
you.
hear about all the different ways you've made an impact on training, education, the future of AI ethics. I love talking about that, the bias and all that AI stuff, because it's thought-provoking and it's topical and I think it is interesting, and it's like we're in this crazy time where it's happening for the first time, and I feel like, all right, well, it's kind of fun to see history. Who knows what will happen? But you gave us a lot to think about, and we're so grateful for your time and expertise. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been great.
Awesome. To our listeners, thank you for tuning in to this episode of the e-learning lounge. If you enjoyed our conversation today, please be sure to share it and leave us a review. We'll be back soon with more conversations on the cutting edge of learning and development here in the e-learning lounge. Until then, I'm Josh Sternlicht. Keep exploring, keep learning, and always stay curious.